Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
All right, in line, I have Robert Engels, and he's joining me from Johannesburg. We are going to talk a little bit about South Africa, because he has been a legal consultant and a lawyer there for a while. He's also from the northwest area of South Africa. I think that we are both just a tiny bit under the weather, if anybody can tell that, but we're going to make it through this interview. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Robert.
It's an honor to be here.
Great, great. So I was contacted by some of your friends there, and they are on a mission to spread the word about some of the things that are going on in South Africa. You also wanted to talk about some of the financial things that are happening. So if we could just like start out and let people know, I mean, what is it? If you had to express it succinctly, what exactly is going on right there that you think people need to be aware of?
From my side, we are facing what I would like to call a white economic genocide. And it's all done legally under legislation, whereas freedoms are taken away and your share in the marketplace or your participation in the marketplace has been limited by legislation. And even if it's your own business, if you earn above a certain threshold, you can't conduct business unless you have given away a certain amount of your shareholding and management of your company. This has pushed people to a point where in the fiscal year of 2016, 120,000 South Africans left to either Australia, Canada, the UK, the Netherlands, wherever they could go. I mean, some of them even went to Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. We also have a situation where with a vast economic uncertainty and the fact that white people are struggling to find jobs, at least one in four white people and their children are food insecure and shelter insecure. Mm. I mean, we're looking at squatter camps where these people are living, and it's an absolute, the conditions are squalid. I mean, and it's the health care they get is absolutely, well, it's basically non-existent. They're not getting any social grants. They have to scrounge and beg to stay alive. Now, yes, we do. There are some initiatives within South Africa from the churches and also now from America to release funding to these people to actually just live, mm-hmm. which is very sad, you know, because, you know, why do you have to rely on someone else to live?
Right.
Because they can't get jobs and they're largely excluded. And these people are mostly uneducated. So it's not like they have the mental faculties or the capabilities to go out and start a business, because it is still then again linked to legislation, which we call Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment, or the BEE Act as we know it here. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a lot of those people, they seem to also be, you know, subject to, you know, physical violence. I've seen some really crazy articles and people that are just attacking your standard farmers. It seems like they're, a lot of them are elderly people and things like that. It's just horrific.
This is a fairly new phenomenon. When I say new, it's like in the last 10 years. Many of these radicals, they believe that your wealth is determined by the amount of property you own. And to them, farmland is wealth, because they want the cattle, they want the grain, they want the corn, they want the implements, they want the houses. And unfortunately, none of them have the technical skills to even run a farm or even a small business. So this is purely an act of retribution or an act of revenge for because they believe these farmers are keeping them impoverished.
Wow. But, you know, I've seen a lot of these incidents where they're torturing these people or killing them or something, but it's not like they're trying to take over the farm. I think that probably a lot of the propaganda and other types of things that they've been told about these, you know, evil white people that, you know, they get off by hurting these people, you know, it's messed up.
Well, it does have a massive knock-on effect, whereas we're seeing farmers now selling their property off at absolute bargains, just not to be there anymore. They are so intimidated, they are scared. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be there anymore. So they're selling off their property, and unfortunately this causes other problems, because according to our receiver of revenue, you cannot alienate any fixed property unless you get fair market value for it. And these people are selling it off at 50% or 60% of what the fair market value is.
Right.
So it creates a tax problem.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the basis for what, you know, some of these policies and this type of thing is about. So You talked about the black economic empowerment policies.
Yes.
Could you explain a little bit of that, about that, when they started and what exactly those policies are that they have put into place?
Basically, black economic empowerment was a continuance of the apartheid government's development program, except now it's completely in reverse. In 1997, they tried to implement what they call affirmative action. And unfortunately, or not unfortunately, it was so easily circumvented due to the fact that you could go to anybody on the street and tell them, African male or African female, and say, look, I know you, you know me, you're a director now in my company, and I'm going to give you $50 a month to be a director. And these people were happy with it, you know, because suddenly they're director, they're getting $50 more than a month than they would have normally got. And then the government quickly cottoned on and said, no, we don't want management, we want ownership. Now, the thing is, we need to differentiate between director and shareholder. A director is simply management. A shareholder is ownership. Mm-hmm. And so they aggressively started with a system, and which was promulgated into an act called the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, and it set out codes and schedules for you and your business how to run it. If you earn less than $500,000 a year, you're exempt from black economic empowerment, but you are still listed, so which means you're a level 4 contributor, which means you can only tender for any business up to, you know, thumbsuck here, up to $1 million. You know, the thing is, if they catch you actually not complying with the Black Economic Empowerment Act, you could be fined up to 25% of your turnover, not your profit. Your turnover is a massive loss to any company. Mm. Now, what happened was that many people would simply just, well, we're not participating in this, and we simply participate in the private sector. However, if you want to do business, and whoever you're doing business with has any dealings with the government, because the government is still the biggest employer, and the government is still the biggest money spinner for private enterprise out there, you cannot subcontract or enter into any joint venture with another company if you don't have the required BE capital, which means you need at least, for a level 3 contributor, you need at least 30% black ownership. Mm. For a level 1 contributor, you need at least between 70 to 100% black ownership. Oof. And I'm talking about giving it away.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about these people coming in to buy it. I'm talking about them giving it away.
What? My God. So you have to give 30% of your, up to 70% or 100% of your stock? Just give it to somebody?
And, yes. What happened recently, I was employed by a Joburg Stock Exchange listed company, which was the biggest utility service provider in the Southern Hemisphere. Brian Coco from Eskom came to us, and Brian Mulefi, and said, before you get any order from us again, we want 30% of your shareholding, which is a major problem.
Yeah.
Because the problem being, according to our company's act, for any special resolution to remove somebody, you need 75% on a special vote of your shareholders and your management. Now, the second they get 30% of the shareholding, you can never outvote them. They can never leave,
right,
because they've got 30%. So they are exempt from the act. And we said no, and we said, but we thought we had legislation behind us, because they weren't willing to pay for it, they wanted it for free. And we said, well, we're not going to do that. And they said, well, you're never getting an order from us again. I said, but we've got the act where this product has been marked as designated. It's South African built, it's South African sourced, and we are the only company in South Africa that builds these components up to this size. And they said, well, sorry, you're not getting another order from us. And so they went behind Treasury's back, they went behind everybody's back. And this was also in the state capture report. They went to places like India, or what we call the BRICS countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China. And so they just sourced everything from the south, from either Brazil or China or India.
Wow.
And completely, completely, completely shattered the company. And it got so bad, I mean, When this company was running up and running at full tilt, we were in excess of 13,000 employees. We had a full legal service center of 35 legal counsel. When we were asked to leave, there was less than six left, and the company shrunk from 13,000 people down to less than 2,000.
So for these policies that they have in place now, for the companies that started before they were put in place, were they grandfathered in, or do they now have to, boom, like according to, you know, starting today, you have to give away 50% of your company?
No, this is something new. I mean, and I'm talking about companies that are 70 to 100 years old that are no more, that don't exist anymore. And these were stock exchange listed companies. The stock is worth nothing because these companies are being wound up and they're sold off.
Right.
We're seeing an extremist movement coming up now. And this is linked to the bell potting effect. I believe we're going to speak on that a little later, which is black first, land first, under Andile Mkimata. I can't really pronounce his surname, whereas they believe that, you know, white should pay for black education and every black should be automatically exempt to qualify for any course they would want to study at university. So, which means if you've got a 30% pass rate, or you've got 30% for math and science in your senior year of high school, you could actually qualify to go and study medicine. I don't know if you'll pass or if you'll just be put through, but this is the attitude. And this was unfortunately due to a word made up, which they now call white monopoly capital. And so we're seeing this now in all sectors of private life, whereas you're white, it automatically means you're guilty. It automatically means you have to pay. And also we can see it happening now, whereas any person earning in excess of $100,000 a year is now taxed at 49% of your disposable income.
So let's talk about the white monopoly capital myth, as you called it. What is this and why is it incorrect?
Our public protector, a lady by the name of Thuli Madonsela, there were rumors started that there was these three Indian brothers, the Gupta brothers from India. And I mean, you couldn't get any tender or you couldn't supply anything to government if it hadn't passed them. And I mean, at the end of the day, they were supplying everything. Then there came a massive tender through for nuclear energy plants from Rosatom in Russia. And we said, but we're not ready for nuclear energy. I mean, we do not have the capabilities. We do not have the necessary nuclear physicists to look after a nuclear plant. And we were asking, why would you have to spend in excess of $100 billion on a nuclear plant which we won't be able to maintain? And people started digging, and the forensic auditor started digging. And we found out, but the only supplier of uranium in South Africa were these three brothers. They had gone in and with some hostile takeovers, taken over uranium mines and bought out stock. So they were the sole suppliers. So people started asking questions. And the public protector at that time released a state capture report, which was very damaging to the president. It showed he had an irresponsible relationship with these three brothers. It showed that the three brothers had offered a finance minister $60 million as a bribe if he would give them access to the state treasury, because then they could plunder at will. And so they were seen in a very, very negative light. So they contacted Bell Pottinger, which is a PR firm from London, and they consulted with them and said, look, we need to save our image. Something needs to be done so we can continue with our business. And they got this, I can't pronounce the surname, I don't know how it's pronounced, got this lady in on a retainer for £100,000 sterling a month to save the image. And the one thing she did was, well, there is no image to save, but we need to draw attention away from you. And she came up with the words white monopoly capital, and everybody ran with it. And I mean, it's a bell that cannot be unrung right now. It's never going to be unrung.
Okay, and what? Sorry, go ahead.
And with that came Black First, Land First, under Andile, and he is known to be also have a very inappropriate relationship with the Gupta brothers because they finance him, and he was running with what Bell Pottinger had thought up, and Bell Pottinger was appointed in 2015, and within the space of 2 years, completely destroyed an economy. Absolutely. And now Bell Pottinger is just saying, well, we fired the guilty people, but we didn't know what was happening. which I don't think is I don't think is the case, because they have been dealing with very suspect clients in the past, and they are, you know, to me, allegedly, they are very unscrupulous. It's absolutely shocking what they did.
Right, and I read in an article that at the same time, this company was also, at least prior, you know, it's up to question whether at the same time they were receiving money from the government, that they were also promoting this state capture scheme and the white monopoly capital myth. Is that right?
Yes, what they did is after they found out that certain ministers, the minister that was offered $60 million, immediately went to the public protector and said, this is an inappropriate relationship. I've been offered this amount of money. Unfortunately, this is the oath I took in office, and I'm not willing to take this money. And so they went on, so Bell Pottinger went on a smear campaign against all the people that actually spoke out against the Gupta family and what we were seeing happening as state capture. So they are very clever spin doctors. And, well, everybody, even the public protector, was smeared by Bell Pottinger. And, well, the knock-on effect after that was, well, who's lying to who then?
Right.
So it created a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the way I'm reading this is that some people in the government directly hired this company to spread propaganda to help them with a state capture scheme where they could get control over the treasury and many other things, basically push communism through racial divides. I mean, you know, this is just right from the playbook, you know, incredible. And so the basis of this is the white monopoly capital. And so, again, I just wanted that. So what is the, you know, what is the story? What do they say? What is this white monopoly capital? What does that mean?
White monopoly capital means that erroneously they believe that 90% of South African wealth is in white hands. It is not so. Mm-hmm. And keeping in mind that they're saying that white-owned farms are the money spinners, whites own less than 20% of the land in this country. 60% of the land is owned by the government. And yet the government is not willing to give away land. And so it comes down to white monopoly capital is something that was generated on the backs of black labor. You know, so it's this country was built with their skill, earnestly again. So it was built on their skills, and we just took it from them, you know, by illegal means, by way of apartheid, even post-apartheid. And even when you bring up the issue that, look, you've been born or you've been an independent, free from apartheid since 1994. Why is this still an issue? And I said, but the money is still in white hands. And the issue, the main issue is they don't want to pay for the shares. They don't want to pay for the business. They want the businesses. They want the money. They want the farmlands. They want to alienate fixed property without any form of compensation. And this is what the president is also now pushing. Mm. So, but as we can see, there is no basis for anything to even remotely be called white monopoly capital. I spoke to a black surgeon the other day who said, yes, and I agree with him, that the evils of apartheid were real. And it was like a marathon race, and the white people ran unshackled, and the black people were shackled. And he said, but you don't stop a marathon front runner. You simply just unshackle the guy at the back, and you just give him an opportunity to run. And that to me was a very, very wise answer and very concisely put. And many of them are also, you know, wising up to the fact that, yes, but I'm actually responsible for my own wealth. I had to go to university. I had to pay for it. I had to become a doctor. I had to become an engineer. I had to do this or that, or I had to start my own business. And those entrepreneurs are actually very successful. And they also reject the lie of white monopoly capital. And to be honest with you, there is no real definition of what the word white monopoly capital is. Mm. It's a made-up word thrown into the media by these provocateurs, and we don't know what you're actually talking about.
Yeah, it's amazing, and we just see this stuff, and it's, you know, all over the world, and it's so damaging. And, you know, a lot of people want to believe it, a lot of people like to believe it, because it means that, you know, they have a reason to take money from someone else, or, you know, claim that they're a victim. And it's very hard to dislodge a lot of the brainwashing or lies that people get told, especially when they're benefiting from it. Do you have any proposals, like moving forward? What do you think are some of the ways that they can have a more positive outcome of this?
To be honest with you, the continent is lost. It's gone. I'm looking for opportunities in the US or somewhere, because honestly, I can't live on this continent anymore due to the fact that it's so uncertain. Yes, obviously it's violent and all, but at this moment, you know, violence to me is taking a second spot due to the fact that we have no idea what's going on. You don't know where your next money is coming from. You don't know what's happening next. And we tried to rectify the situation, and we tried for a long time. And I mean, for 23 years, we tried to rectify this. And, well, South Africa is lost.
Mm. What's the situation like as far as, you know, say you're looking for opportunities in the U.S.? Is it hard for you as someone from South Africa to go to the United States or Australia or one of these other countries that you might have some more opportunity at this point? Is that a hard process?
It's an extremely hard process due to the fact that we're not seen as white South Africans. We're seen as Africans. Huh. It doesn't matter what you bring to the table. You are still regarded as an African. We're regarded as illiterate. We're regarded as stupid, and we're regarded as lazy and conniving.
Wow.
And unfortunately, yeah. So and many places have shut their borders to us. But this is also a knock-on effect for apartheid. Because we were the pariah back then, and we governments and public figures and leaders can't be seen now fraternizing with the erstwhile enemy, because then they would almost like be agreeing, yes, but maybe these people had a point, maybe they were right, maybe we should now help them. And unfortunately, it becomes an issue of being caught with egg on your face to actually assist and help these people. I do have a 3-point plan, which I'm not going to divulge now, but it's a workable plan for to be what they call an economic refugee, and to be economic refugees on a large scale. You know, and I'm talking about a couple of 100,000 people being displaced and whatnot, and you know, wherever they could go to.
Okay. What about the financial situation as far as the bonds and the stock market in general there? What has been the outcome of that, say, over the last 5 to 10 years?
I don't know if you've ever heard of Lonmin Mine.
No.
Lonmin is a UK-owned company that was they had a mine, a platinum mine, out in close to Rustenburg. And, I mean, these guys were absolutely mining extremely high-quality platinum, and there was a lot of it. And then certain politicians went to the miners and said, well, you need to ask for at least X amount of money. And the mines went back to them and said, no, we're not going to give you that, because we clothe you, we feed you, we still give you a basic salary, we give you free medical care, and your kids go to school for free. And so they just embarked on a massive strike action, and eventually two of the shafts closed down, and Lonmin disinvested from South Africa. Then there was what we call the Lonmin Massacre, where they got very aggressive about their demands, and then hacked two policemen to death. And the police responded and killed 14 of them in a very brutal firefight. If you go onto YouTube, you can look for the Lonmin Massacre, and it will be there. And Lonmin just said, enough. You know, we still have this one shaft running. It's running at a loss. We're disinvesting. And so they left, and as of late, BMW has disinvested, Chevrolet has disinvested from South Africa, but Chevrolet has disinvested due to the fact that their sales figures were just poor. I mean, they were absolutely going nowhere. So that's why they disinvested from South Africa. We've gotten to a point where the company that I used to work for, their share price was running at roughly about $50 a share. Currently, due to the downsizing and everything, it's running at 15 cents a share. Our currency fluctuates so much right now. Every time our president opens his mouth, I mean, it just goes to hell. We're under stress. We've been downgraded to junk status. And the sad thing is, with junk status or with the companies, they build their losses into their profits due to every time the president speaks, they've got an idea how much a currency is going to devaluate. So they work it as into losses into the company. So that's covered by them. Unfortunately, we're seeing large-scale retrenchments. Retrenchment is where you cut off the workforce that is now redundant, but they're not really redundant. You just can't pay them anymore because there's no more money to pay them. And so our stock market, some stocks are really performing well, but none of it in South Africa. Most of it is outside of South Africa, except for the one company, Bidvest. But Bidvest is also an international company, and it seems like they're mostly moving all the operations to Australia.
Okay. Is there any type of investments in that area of the continent that you think might look good or anything at all?
From what we're seeing, it looks like Botswana and Namibia is still safe. Mm-hmm. It's a very investor-friendly countries. Mm-hmm. They're very pro-foreigner. You're actually allowed to own property in Namibia as an American if you're actually doing something with it. You'll find out there these major safari outfits owned by American people, but they're doing something with it. They're actually generating money. It's not like they've got the safari outfit and they come to Africa once a year for 2 months, hunt, and then just leave back to the US. The American dollar speaks very, very loudly in Namibia. Mm-hmm. It is an extremely investor-friendly country. The reason why nobody can go there, it's an arid country. It doesn't have the infrastructure to support more people coming in. And the same with Botswana. And Botswana is a landlocked country. And it's also arid, so it's desert. It's filled to capacity. There's nothing else we can do.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you about something that I saw. There's a list that came out on travelandleisure.com. And it was by their readers, and it was the top 15 cities in the world. And they actually rated Cape Town as number 8, as the number 8 top city in the world. So what do you think about that?
Cape Town is like a different city on a different continent. Mm. It is extremely expensive. And what they've done is, by making it too expensive for other people to come and live there, they've created a very exclusive society. But Cape Townians are also, overall, they are completely oblivious as to what's happening in the rest of South Africa, whereas we from Johannesburg, we're cynical, we're more aggressive, we tend to be rushed. If you go down to Cape Town, I mean, driving in Cape Town is probably one of the most frustrating experiences ever, because the speed limit is 72 miles an hour, but they'll drive at 50 miles an hour. Mm. And it's like, why would you want to do this today when you can do it tomorrow? And they are completely oblivious, and it's very clicky. They don't like outsiders very much. But the problem is now there's a massive migration from Johannesburg down to Cape Town, mm-hmm. which they don't like either. But to come back to the tourism thing, mm-hmm. you can't base a tourist industry on one single city. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this is the face of South African tourism, is Table Mountain, Lion's Head, and Cape Town, and Cape Town surroundings, which is all the wine farms. It's Stellenbosch, which is a very old city. It's a very touristy French Hook, which is also it was built by the French, and it's wine farms, very expensive, very exclusive. So people tend to go there. I was like, but South Africa's fantastic. I mean, we went to Cape Town. It's like, no, but you didn't go down to Durban. You didn't go down to Pretoria. You didn't see Joburg. Mm-hmm. So how can you base an opinion on one single city? And most people just go down to Cape Town. What for?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, and I wanted to talk about this stuff. I thought it was a very interesting topic because – a lot of people, for whatever reason, they don't know about what's going on in South Africa. It seems to be, at least a lesson that people in the West can learn from, can look at. The propaganda and the narrative seems to be very similar to other kind of communist or leftist narratives that gets put out in the media throughout the world, and that we're seeing a lot of that. And so I just want people to understand how, devastating it can be to the economy. And again, when you see these pictures of people being murdered and tortured and stuff like that, completely innocent people that have, you know, lived there for generations, and now you have people that they've just been brainwashed to hate everything about them. I think it's a wake-up call for a lot of people.
Yes, but the thing is, what you need to understand as well, the apartheid government was a socialist government as well. The whole financial model was built on national socialism. They just copied the Nazi model and just continue with it. Wow. So that was already the setup for failure. Mm-hmm. Yes, we were allowed to have our own businesses and whatnot, but we were still taxed at 42% or 39%. And there were obscenity laws. There was one healthcare provider, which was the government. The government was the biggest job provider. Railways, roads, municipalities, everything was government. Mm. You know, and so when we moved over to a new dispensation, which is the ANC government, it just basically continued, just in reverse now. And the problem is with our politicians, any form of failure on their side, they are pushing the narrative, yes, but it was apartheid's fault. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they even blame the AIDS pandemic that's happening in KwaZulu-Natal. And I mean, the birth rate is in the negatives. They're actually shrinking. Oh. And this... And they had a commission of inquiry to find out what the hell happened, and they came back and said, "Well, it's apartheid's fault."
So you know, you went from one very status model to another one. Well, all right. Well, is there anything else? I mean, so for people listening to this, maybe they want to find out more, or are there any sort of causes or something that they can support, or something to find out more about what's going on here? Is there any place that you can direct people to?
Well, yes, there's a lady by the name of Karen Smith. She has a charity set up for these white squatter camps. Other than that, you know, just Google search words like white monopoly capital, Bell Pottinger, black economic empowerment, or state capture, and it'll give you a very, very good idea as to what is happening. You can even Google farm attacks, and it will throw up a slew of information regarding what is happening right now. It's surreal. It is absolutely surreal what has happened.
Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, as a person from there, and again, you know, people that have been there for generations, and now all this happens. And so, you know, as a person that has lived through this, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like for you to maybe leave us with some advice or some things that, you know, others can learn from it, or, you know, as far as political or economic lessons that can be learned from it that you would like to pass on to others.
First of all, freedom of speech is incredibly important. Keep in mind that freedom of speech is a double-edged sword, which means Antifa, with what they're doing, is also a form of freedom of speech, as long as there's no violence element to it. Personal freedom and liberty, do never, ever, ever step away from it. Because the second you do, you become a slave to a government. And unfortunately, it is happening all over the world. Thirdly, keep your economy simple. You know, the second you get your government involved in economies, you get regulations, you get over-regulated industries, and suddenly now you're being taxed because what was legal yesterday is not legal anymore today. And you can actually go to jail for that. I think lastly... capitalism is unfair. Yes, it is. But it's the only system that works. Socialism is just an equal share of misery. And with capitalism, you're actually encouraged to go out, do your own thing. You're the master of your own prosperity, if you're willing to go for it, if you're willing to look for it. Basically, that is what I can leave you with. Mm-hmm. And this is a lesson for the future. And also... political correctness, because the second you bring in affirmative action into any work area, nothing happens on merit anymore. The second you take merit out of your out of the equation, you're getting in people that are substandard and people that, well, they're not contributing anything to your company. They're not doing anything to raise your share price. They're not doing anything to management. It's simple. It's just a continuation of being mediocre and being absolutely useless.
Mm-hmm. All right, Robert. Well, thanks a lot for spending some time with us today. It's very unfortunate, but an interesting turn of events, and we're all watching that as well as a lot of other kind of similar things that are going on in different parts of the world. Let's definitely keep in touch. And again, I thank you for sharing us your story.
It's a pleasure. It's actually an honor to be on your show.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.